Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program was brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Erica Wise, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And today we're going to be talking about Cuba, or Cuba. Cuba, it is so much in the news now as relations are unfreezing and thawing, slowly. I guess you could say, slowly, right? And there's so much for us to discover, and travel restrictions are being lifted, and as well as many of the embargoes. And I think people are more and more curious about Cuba, and of course, for me, that means Cuban cuisine. When we think of Cuba and Cuban cuisine, I know people usually think of fried plantains, black bean soup, a Cuban sandwich, of course, and basically anything you've read in the news or seen pictures of, which is unfortunately, you know, people kind of sitting in the street strumming guitars, enjoying life, but not eating perhaps as plentiful as they once did. And so much of the Cuban cuisine is being reproduced from memory by people who left their home. Someone who took a trip back to Cuba to try to put this together and is of Cuban descent is Ana Sofía Peláez, and she has written, along with Ellen Silverman, who was a wonderful photographer. Her poignant pictures really paint a true representation, I think. She wrote a book called The Cuban Table, and she has delved into a lot of the history of Cuban cuisine, and I welcome her. Welcome, Ana.
It's wonderful to be here.
So you have always been interested in the food, and you've had a blog for a long time called Hungry Sophia. And your family, you learned to cook from your family. But that was an interesting trek in itself. So can you tell me a little bit about your background?
Well, I grew up in Miami. I was born...
That's little Cuba, right?
It's Northern Havana, as we call it. I grew up in a Cuban family. And that was something that we always did together. My grandparents came to the United States in the early 60s, and they were very busy in Cuba. They both had careers, and they learned to cook, you know, as recent exiles in the United States.
So they had servants cooking for them at home.
They had help at home. Yeah. They had a large family that would gather together for these, you know, very elaborate lunches. So they weren't part of the process of cooking at home until they got here, and then they were struggling a little bit as you know, it's very difficult when you first arrive to a new country and you're learning a new language, everything that entire process. So they learned to cook. A neighbor saw that they were flailing a little bit, and she decided to teach them, you know, lend them a hand, and she taught them to cook Cuban food is what they were taught, and so it was something that they came to late in life, and it was something that they fell in love with, and I think I was the beneficiary of that enthusiasm that they had for it. So I was kind of, you know, had the best view. I had the little bench that they would set up for me in the kitchen, so I got to see them cook every day and go to the markets with my grandfather and come back home and watch my grandmother make these wonderful desserts. And so it was really something that, you know, was part of my everyday. I spent a lot of time with them. I love being in their home. So I think that was my impression of Cuban food was through them.
Well, and you mentioned that they were taught by friends and neighbors and other relatives, everybody trying to recapture their memories and the flavors and the foods that they left, because
yes,
they left their home. I would imagine that many of the ingredients were not available to them in the 60s when they got here.
I think that's something that I took for granted, that there was something that was always available to them. And when I was researching the book and I was speaking to different, you know, providers in Florida, they said, no, that didn't happen. We didn't have a maize until the 70s. Like they could pinpoint when certain products that I always thought of as tropical, so it made sense that they would grow in Florida the same as they would in Cuba, that there was actually, just as my family came and immigrated, the fruit came with them and the vegetables right, and the things that they had to grow, and this demand, this new market that they created in South Florida, a lot of these products were introduced later. And I think their excitement for them, I thought, I confused it with just, you know, I have to try a sapote and it's wonderful and it's amazing and you're going to love it. But it was really, they were rediscovering it at the same time. So to me, that was very poignant, because I understood a little bit more about why it was so special and so important for them to share these things with me.
Well, and it's interesting, because so many of our memories are shaped by cooking with our families, or memories can be stimulated by a certain smell or mm-hmm. a taste of an old flavor that they'll spark a memory in people. And the Cuban cuisine, so you did all this cooking and you've been writing this wonderful blog and you've been rediscovering the flavors. Then you decided to research it, big time, and you went back to Cuba. Tell me, what did you find when you arrived?
This was my second trip back to Cuba, and so the first time I had been was in 2000, and this last time was in 2013, and it was a bit of a shock, because when I was first there in 2000, they would reference things that I was used to having that to me were part of everyday Cuban cuisine, what you would have with your family, what would be a weeknight meal. It was something that was very much part of what I thought of as Cuban food. This last time that I went back in 2013, there were so many things that I had realized fallen out of memory in such a short period. The first time I was there, it was shortly after the special period, which was when the subsidies were pulled from mm-hmm. by the Soviet Union, so Cuba went into a very, very steep economic crisis. They would reference a lot of things that they maybe hadn't had in a couple of years, but there was always the sense of, like, it's going to come back, or it was for a short time. And when I was speaking to chefs or speaking to people who worked in Paladares, they would tell me about younger people who were training or who were working in their restaurants that would ask them to show them things that they had never in their lifetime had.
And
that
was born into this
they didn't
life of
know,
scarcity.
Huh? They didn't know any differently. They didn't know differently. And it was interesting, because one of the questions that I asked every subject that I had, and that was in New York, Miami, wherever, or in Cuba, was, you know, what kind of dishes do you remember that you don't have anymore? When I would ask this question in Miami, it was always something that was, you know, maybe very Baroque, a very, very rich dessert that tastes change. We don't have quite as much of a sweet tooth as we did. You adapt a little bit, or things that were very labor intensive that would take was part of how you lived, where you had a lot of hands in the kitchen. So it was the entire family wasn't there. Now we live in smaller configurations. So it made sense why these things were no longer being made, like escabeche, that maybe it was a process that was a little bit, something that had fallen out of general use. When I asked this question in Cuba, they said things like, ropa vieja, anything that, any kind of beef-based dishes were very difficult.
No beef.
There's no beef. Right. So it was, you know, frituras de bacalao, which are just, for us, are just very kind of general street food that you would have in any cafeteria, any restaurant in Miami. You could just have it on the go. And anything with fish was very, it was very hard for them to find. So these things that were just every day, I realized that those were the things that were difficult to for them to have, and they fell out not just of you know, being able to have them, but just being them, having them be part of your diet and what you think of as this cultural output that you have, this shared cuisine that you all what you all know of as Cuban food.
So for the past 50 years, basically their cuisine was one of survival.
Right. It was one of survival. It was one of improvisation, mm-hmm. and a lot of substitutions and
adaptation.
And I think one of the things that I found was that they were people that were holding on, and people who did remember, like I did, cooking with their grandparents and the things that they could make. So they were as invested as I was in, you know, saying, I know this recipe, I'm not able to make it, but I remembered, and this is something that my family did. So they would hold on to it in the same way for different reasons. For me, it was, you know, trying to hold on to what I knew of from my family when in a multicultural environment, and when you leave your house, it's a very different, you know, your what you live in your home is not reflected in the outside world. So you hold on to what you love and what you grew up with. For them, it was wanting to, you know, just feeling like there's going to be a moment where you're going to be able to try these things or make these things or recover.
Yeah, someone will find that ingredient at some point, somewhere along either the black market or someone from a farm, right?
Yeah, it was actually something that I always had to remember to ask, because people would give me these recipes and then they would get to the end and I say, okay, that's all, you've given me everything. They said, yeah. And they say, oh, but if you find cinnamon and clove, and if you can get fresh milk, use fresh milk. So yeah. I always had to remember for them to give me their wish list, because they've gotten very used to just kind of, you know, doing without. And you mm-hmm. could taste some of the recipes, something that is like requires a lot of ingredients, like an arroz con pollo, which is almost like, you know, a paella, which it's a slow
chicken
simmer.
Chicken and rice, right.
Chicken and rice, a lot of different spices. You can kind of see what, you know, what they kind of leave out.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your book, you did mention that you would arrive at someone's house armed with a lot of ingredients, that you didn't really want to stretch their resources when you would go to cook with them. So you were very sensitive to this. And
well, I was very aware of it in my own family. When we were able to visit our family, we didn't want to strain their resources. And even the families who have support, especially from the outside, family who left and sends regular supplies and money and whatever, you know, whatever they have to share, they can do well. And to a certain extent, you know, they can have, you know, sufficient, they can get enough of what they need, but it's, you can't take anything for granted. Mm-hmm. They never have extra. Even you see somebody who has, you know, is a professor or someone who's a doctor, someone who you would think of as being able to be comfortable. There's nothing, you know, they don't take anything for granted. There's nothing that they can kind of say like, oh yeah, well there's plenty. And it was hard to see, just because I know how generous Cubans are, and they were very generous, and they were very generous with their time and what they knew, and anything that they had to offer, they were going to give it to me. And that it was very much the same in Miami. Whatever you asked for, they were going to want to give it to you. They were going to try and give it to you. It's just very limited, and I didn't want to put them in that position. So if I could find a way of bringing something, or, you know, just having that conversation, or just making it so that I was going to go to the market so it was easier for them.
What can I get for you?
Right? What can I get? What can I bring? And right. Or going to a paladar was actually an ideal situation, because the paladares are the private restaurants that are, in theory, run from someone's home, and where a family was allowed to have a license to operate a small restaurant with a lot of limitations, but they were able to do this. That was kind of like the perfect thing, because you were set up. You could be a paying customer, you can have a conversation. It was a home cook, so it was the perfect kind of blend. It was those were the best subjects.
Right. Still, they had to buy, but they had to buy retail. They were not allowed, these home restaurants were not allowed to buy from the wholesale food market.
Well, that was one of the restrictions that I heard from everyone who I spoke to. They said, well, you know, we don't have a wholesale market yet. So if I, you know, buy, you know, that costs me X amount a pound, it costs the same person that's going to the grocery store. So I have to charge more for that. So for a Cuban who's on such a limited, I mean, we say limited budget. This is beyond a limit. This is, you know, just really trying to stretch every resource they have. You're not going to go to a restaurant. I always say it's like, imagine like every restaurant might as well be per se. It's not something that you can do. It's something that, you know, you might do on a special occasion, but it's not going to be part of your everyday experience. It's not something recreational that you're going to do. So in a lot of the restaurants that I went to, they were strictly for the tourist market. And I think a lot of the things that they produced were always keeping in mind of trying to sell, trying to know that anything that they, any ingredients that they invested in was going to have a return for them. So what I always did with any Barada chef was say, okay, beyond what they were cooking for what they were doing in the restaurant or what was on the menu, I'd ask them, what did you remember cooking? What did your family teach you? What do you love of Cuban food? Trying to take it back to what their personal experience was, because it wasn't always reflected in their menu. Some people could do it, some people couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
depending on what kind of background they had.
Depending on what kind of background.
Right. Well, speaking of background, I want to take like three giant steps back. And that is, first of all, we have to identify Cuban cuisine, which that's like identifying, it's like nailing Jell-O to a wall. So
yeah.
Identifying Cuba, and you know, well, there were the native population that were there, the Taino, the Arawaks, and the Indians. But then there was such an influx of cultures, the Spanish, obviously, mm-hmm. the Portuguese, the Caribbean influences. Africa is a big influence, and that all forms Cuba. And then there was some Chinese influence, some French.
There was French. There was, you know, it was a port.
It's quite, you know, quite an amalgamation of, or amalgam of cultures and flavors and cuisines. But as you have pointed out in past writings too, much of the Cuban cuisine is made up of some of these pre-Columbian ancient ingredients, the tubers. In fact, the tubers that still are difficult to find, even in, you know, New York, where you think you can find everything, mm-hmm. right? So talk about some of these original ingredients that sort of separate. We tend to lump, I think, Cuban cuisine in with all the Latino cuisines mm-hmm. that you know, we think, okay, rice and beans, plantains, you know, all these, you know, these things. Tell me, for you, what you've discovered really separates and makes the Cuban cuisine unique. What are the flavors stand out as being unique to Cuba?
What I love of Cuban food, it does set it apart a little bit from other, what we think of as other of Latin food, or say specifically like Mexican food or Central American, is that it's very simple. It's very much focused on the ingredients. I think maybe it's because you don't want to sit there, you know, over stove trying a lot of different things in that kind of like heat and humidity. It can be very oppressive. So it was very much about just having these tubers, these vegetables, these fruits, these spices that we would put together very quickly, and then you walk away from it. And then you let it simmer for
a
long time.
Right.
So it's very much about, it's about the technique. It's about kind of keeping an eye on things and watching for things to happen. If that's a simple plate of black beans, to me, what sets us apart is the black beans. It's very much about the texture. It's just watching it. It starts with a very simple base of the sofrito, which, you know, I think it's very similar to the Cajun Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
Except for us, it's the bell pepper, the onion, and the garlic. And they would always, a lot of cooks would give me that as like, well, you do your seasonings. They wouldn't even specify that as like a separate ingredient. They
it's
would
like, if you don't know that, you don't
yeah,
know
Yeah, you just say like a sofrito. Like that was kind of like its own thing, like salt and pepper. So I think that's the basis of so many of our dishes. When I think about the testing period for this book, it's like I'm always imagining myself grabbing that bell pepper because I must have gone through every bell pepper in New York at one point. So I think that's always kind of like the key it comes back to. And then you know you just start building the dish, and it's about you engage with it in a different way, because it's like the black beans, you're simmering them with that initial sofrito and the bay leaves, and then you kind of have these, you're just watching it to kind of go to that point where it just gets that little bit muddy and it just starts to thicken. So you engage with it in a different way.
Creaminess.
Yeah. It just becomes that little bit, just like it just thickens. It just velvety. It's wonderful. And so you're watching it, and it's about the technique, and it's not about throwing a lot of different spices or a long list of chiles, or which are wonderful. I love them in Mexican food, but it's not necessarily, there's not the complexity that you have in Mexican food, but to the other extreme, I love the simplicity of it, because the ingredients are really shine through, and it's really about finding the best possible product. It's about finding, you know, finding those tubers and finding the yuca and the malanga and putting it all together, and every one of it kind of, you add it into the pot and it kind of does its work, and it melts in and it deepens the flavor. But it's a very limited repertoire, but I think it's wonderful for being that. And I think, you know, because we have all of these influences, we're very focused on like what the ingredients are as far as like what people are bringing in. Mm. So the Spanish, you know, is very much like, you know, if you had like the Spanish chorizos and how they were made, it was this kind of like fussiness over like what the quality of what you were using, that I think it seemed like something I learned with my grandparents, but it's kind of had its own comeback where you really pay attention to where things are coming from and mm-hmm. and where you're getting it. So I think that to me that's what sets apart Cuban cooking, is just the kind of engagement you have with it, because you can't walk away from it, you can't cover it up. It's very, I said the opposite, but you know, you can't just not pay attention to what's going on. You can't hide it. Exactly. So in that sense, that's what I love about Cuban food. And again, it's all of these different ingredients that kind of like come together and they play. And
well, we're going to talk about some of these, the origins of some of these influences, when we come back from a short break. So don't go away.
Thanks.
Listening to Cryin' Blues by the California Honey Drops. This is A Taste of the Past on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
The answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Okay, we are back, and I'm speaking with Ana Sofia Pelaez, talking about Cuban cuisine. And, you know, Ana, as we try to trace the history and the uniqueness of Cuban cuisine, Maricel Priscilla has done obviously so much mm-hmm. research and work in this too, and she wrote a wonderful introduction for you in this.
She did. It was beautiful. Incredible.
Yeah. But both you and she talk about how it's very difficult because so much of the technique, as you described, so many of the recipes are really not written down, and that they are passed, they say within families, so there are things that are, you know, original or indigenous to particular families, particular regions, mm-hmm. and they're not really written down and shared. You know, but the very old ones are not. There was no codified language of the cuisine, if you will, other than the sofrito, as you mentioned. And I wonder if you can can we try to trace? You say that you keep coming back to Creole. Flavors that ring out to you that to you, you know, are so totally unique to Cuban cuisine.
Oh, I think we talked about the sofrito, which I think is very much like the savory base. And I think one of the things that I love, and Lourdes Castro, who's one of our contributors,
she's
a wonderful chef, and based in New York, also from Miami, she said something I really love. What she said, you know, you always think of Cuban food and Latin food in general as being very heavy. But especially in Cuban food, you have so many citrus marinades and you have the sour oranges and you have the limes, and there's a brightness to it that I think gets overlooked or people aren't aware of if they're not part of the process, and mm-hmm. everything kind of gets these marinades and you sprinkle lime on everything that, you know, sweet, savory, it kind of brings everything to life in a really lovely way. And I think we always have that little bit of sweetness too. I think even like, you know, we're talking about the black beans, the last thing you do is you give that little teaspoon of sugar at the end. So I think even or picadillo, you always have raisins or you have some sweet element that plays off of the olives and the savory sofrito. So I think those three things always come together in so many different dishes. Or even if it's just because we have these braises that cook forever, they always caramelize in a certain way. You always want to get it to that point where it just becomes that bit rich and there's that little that turns the corner to being sweet that I think we love. And we find a way of bringing those three elements into everything. It always has to be the sweet, sour, and the savory. So it's you want to kind of hit all your points.
Yeah. One thing that we didn't talk, you know, a lot about the stews and those flavors. And of course, beef being, you know, the chickens they can raise maybe in a backyard if they have a piece of, mm-hmm. you know, a little patch. Beef is difficult. Pork has played a big role in the newer cuisine, but it was always a big part of it. Who can you somehow, you know, for us trace some of the influences by the ingredients that they brought with them?
Well, I think pork came from, it was something livestock came with Spain. And that it was also the cattle, like that's what they brought, and they introduced that into what was indigenous was a lot of these tropical vegetables. We talked about the yuca, corn, a lot of the fruits.
Really new world, new world foods. Yeah,
new world foods right. that, you know, we can't imagine without, you know, going without that. But the corn, potato, it all started here. So, and they introduced a lot of these different cuts. The tasajo, which is a dried, cured beef, a way of treating it, was obviously making that voyage from Spain. It was a way of treating these, preserving what they were using. And it was very much about having these long work days and having just really, you know, the agriculture that was going on. And it was a lot of very hearty cuts of meat and vegetables that were coming together. And then, of course, Africa was so important. With that introduction of that, you know, slave labor, which is it was, you know, what they brought with them. Something that I found that was very interesting, they brought the plantains, okra, malanga, and yame, some these other things that you think of as so tropical that you think of them as being, because they work so well in the tropics, and they just
think of them always being part of that culture.
Yeah,
right?
They all flow together so beautifully, but it's a part of this very difficult process of that was happening at the time of this discovery.
Yeah, and sugar with its dark history. I mean, that plays a huge role in the cuisine as well.
It's, you know, cut. It was part of the cuisine, and it was just having to cut the sugar and having to that manufacturing was just that a lot of that had to do with having these incredibly heavy meals in the middle of the day, and then going back to those fields. It's hard work. Yeah. I can't.
Well, that was the culture, much like other countries throughout Europe or Southern Europe, is that taking that siesta, having the family coming together.
Well, that's something when they would talk about these midday meals, they just seem so elaborate to me. I couldn't imagine taking that much time to create these meals every single day. And they said, well, you had your husband would come home, all of your children would come home from school to have that meal at home. Your neighbors might come, somebody who was working with your husband might go to your home instead of, you know, so it would always become these big extended affairs. So I think especially when you talk about, you know, having the pot of beans, you can always add a little bit more water. You can always throw a few more vegetables in. There was always some way of stretching those meals to whoever might turn up.
Yeah, and then a nap in the noonday sun, right?
A nap, yeah, and then everyone back to school, back to work.
Right. What we haven't talked about are the importance of the breads and the pastries. And that there's so much, I guess fried foods is what I'm thinking a lot.
Well, the fried foods, I think it's something that it always comes at the end. To me, it's almost when you talk about memory, if I hear that snap of oil, it's always when we're about to eat. Because I was always like the last, you could hear that sound from the kitchen and you knew that lunch was almost ready or dinner was almost ready. And it makes sense. I think, you know, I talked about having these like stews that you have to kind of watch, but then you kind of have to take your time away from because it was very hot. The fried foods, they're just such good fryers. They just know how to get that oil hot enough so it doesn't get soaked, it doesn't get heavy. And all of these vegetables really lend themselves well to just kind of like, being quickly fried. And when you talk about the plantains, it's just you can't, when you have, it's something that I think I've living in New York after growing up in Miami, not necessarily having like central air, these kind of very acclimated living situations. When I buy fruit or when I buy vegetables, they ripen so quickly and they get away from you. And I think in some ways that's where this cuisine comes from, because you have a plantain, it gets to the point where it blackens and you need to cook it and you don't want it to go to waste. So it's a way of always kind of staying ahead. If you can quickly fry something, it's a way of conserving that food and you know, stretching what you have available to you.
Now, and what about cooking oil? The fat. I mean, I would imagine that cooking fuel and cooking fats were something that probably were in scarce supply during the restrictions. What type of oil would they be, and would they be frying in lard a lot? Or
I think ideally they would fry in lard. I think lard is something that's being revisited or rediscovered in a lot of different ways.
A healthy fat, after all.
They will swear. I think that's something they'll be like, you know, lard's, you know, my grandmother had lard every day and she lived to be 150 years old. So I think it's something that there's a reason that it was an effective. It was something that they could use. So I think that's something you're probably going to see more in the country. I think in the city, what I saw mostly was like pretty, you know, a lot of blended oils, a lot of degraded oils, reusing kind of very bland cooking oils. Mm-hmm. Olive oil was at a premium, but that is something that, you know, because of the Spanish influence, I think you always want to have some. Olive oil is an important part of what we do for some of like the lighter frying or the mm-hmm. sautéing.
Or
so,
finishing or something.
Yeah, finishing. Salads. So I think that was something that they've held on to. So it wasn't great. Like a lot, you can definitely tell a lot of the quality. Sometimes what you had in the city was inferior just from what the ingredients were, what was being used. They used a lot of soy sauce, a lot of soy in everything. So when you got to the country, even though the situation in the country is even more difficult as far as having the variety of ingredients that you might have in the city, the quality was sometimes a little bit better because they had a direct contact with what they were growing or what they were raising. Hmm. So it was probably much more limited in the country, but what you had was better.
Well, I would be remiss if I did not bring up the topic of sandwiches.
Oh.
And, you know, as you mentioned, the noonday meal was the big spread for as part of their past culture. And mm-hmm. Probably in today's society, it's a little more catching.
Here and there, yes.
Yeah, catch as you can go. But I would imagine the evening meal then was a little lighter. Maybe that went, you know, where did the sandwiches play in?
The sandwiches, when they talk about having them in Cuba, were something that was very casual. It was something if you went out, if you were out dancing, you would have a sandwich on your way home. And it's still something that we do. Like a wedding, you'll be at a wedding and you're eating and you're drinking and you still finish it with a sandwich or any kind of sporting event, any kind of, you go to a show, you go to the theater, you go to a concert, you end it with a sandwich. So it's still very much part of that nightlife of just kind of like that last place you hit before you go home. The sandwiches, actually, they're very controversial because they came about at a time early 19th century or early 20th century where the cigar rollers, the cigar industry was bringing workers back and forth to South Florida. It was almost like a commuter town, having these cigar rollers in Key West, and
Key
eventually
West, right?
They moved up to Tampa. So this sandwich that they brought with them, there's a controversy about whether they originated in South Florida or they originated in Cuba. But it was really it's a fake controversy in the sense that at that time there was such a large Cuban presence in South Florida because of the cigar industry that the mayor was Cuban. Everyone was Cuban. So it was almost like, you know, it was a back and forth. So it was very fluid at that time, as, you know, it is now in a sense. So it's hard to pinpoint exactly where it started. I think it's definitely when we start calling it a Cuban sandwich and when you start pressing it and those kinds of things definitely happen in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But the sandwich, the ham and cheese sandwich, that was very Cuban. That was something that we've always done well, and we've always absolutely loved it and obsessed over it, and love making them and talking about them and arguing about who makes it better. So.
Well, and then who's the purist? I mean, do you use fresh ham that's been slow braised, or do you use cured ham and cheese? I mean, the varieties abound.
It's so easy to do, and it's so hard to do well. And I think there's a lot of corners. So I think a lot of people kind of like bristle if like they feel like somebody's, you know, cheating a little bit. And I think definitely when you talk about the history of it, if you have salami in it, if you have Genoa salami, that was something that because a lot of the workers weren't just Cuban, there was a large Italian, there's a lot of Italian immigration. So their Tampa Guano has salami in it, but it's not necessarily inauthentic. It was part of this process. This is just what you ate when you were, this is something that was popular with this group.
Well, one thing you'll get to know about me is that I try to strike the word authentic from any talk of cuisine because it's a pretty gray area, you know.
Yeah,
can't be defined.
If it's good, it's good.
Yeah. Well, and to finish up the discussion in talking about the sandwich, perhaps starting in Florida, before the show, you and I were speaking about Cuban American cuisine because we know that so many different immigrants would arrive on the shores of America and find all this, you know, abundance of food at their ready, and they would adapt their own recipes to include an abundance of meat, mm-hmm. or, you know, cheeses and sauces and varieties. We know from Italy there's a recognized now Italo-American cuisine, its own cuisine, which is so different from what one would find in Italy. And in fact, some of the dishes have transferred back. Do you find this with Cuban cuisine as well? Is there a Cuban-American cuisine, things that have sort of morphed into their own dish?
I think there is. I think there's two big emphasis. Like you said, the portions. You know, we always joke that in Cuban restaurants, a lot of times they would have a placemat with a map of Cuba on it. And then you have, like, you would get, like, a breaded steak that was the size of Cuba. Like, it was always, like, the portions were always, you were always eating an island, basically, you know, regardless of what you ordered. I think the really interesting thing, that it's something that I love about going to Miami, is that so much of the influence has been shaped by having other Latin American nationalities that they live alongside each other in Miami. So in that sense, and it's something that when I went to Cuba, because they don't have free access to the internet, they don't have access to, they can't travel as easily. Cuban food has become very static, and it's been very much about holding on. In Miami, because the Cuban food is it's easier to make and to produce and you can make a lot of different choices, and you have all of these other influences. You can kind of see it evolving a little bit. We don't usually add heat, but obviously living in the United States, you're much more familiar with Mexican food or different. So you can add a little bit of spice. You can add different flavors to it. Or Peruvian is very popular in Miami. Mm-hmm. So I think some of the ceviches or maybe some of like the fishes, the things that we would marinate in citrus that would cook them a little bit. You can kind of see the connection to ceviche and people can have a little bit of fun with that. So I think in that sense, I don't see it as becoming a fusion so much as I see it evolving with other influences and it having the opportunity to kind of to play with different things and not have it be this very static thing, because that's to me, that was what Cuban food always was. It was always an island. It was always a lot of these countries coming in and out, like we talked about, the French and the Chinese and the Spanish and the African and the Caribbean. So to me, that was always part of the process, and I don't feel that there's any point where that should stop. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why we should call it. Okay, 1959, nobody move. So I think it's in that sense, I really love, and I'm seeing a lot of chefs in Miami now, young chefs that are coming up, that they very much have gone back to a very traditional Cuban food that they had in the home, which was in some ways more complex than what you would have at more casual eateries. And they're having fun with it, and they're very true to what that repertoire is. You're gonna get your beans, you're gonna get your braised meats, you're gonna have the same flavor profile. But then they play with it, and they travel, and they can kind of try different things, and they have different people that they're working with, and you have Colombians and Mexicans and Brazilians and Peruvians, and everybody's living alongside each other, so they can see what works and what doesn't work.
And rice, of course, we did talk. I mean, the African influence in the rice, and rice becoming just part of that, of the cuisine.
Well, I love going to Chinatown, because I always, when I see those like just enormous bags of rice and walls full of rice cookers, I feel like I'm home. It's just I think they're the only ones who love it the way we do. So I think rice is always, to me, it's always the anchor. And those are actually my favorite dishes. I think a lot of people, there's something kind of very, you know, there's a one-upmanship to the pork dishes, and definitely the roast pork that we make. And every year at Christmas, it's always trying to get that better. And all the men's kind of standing around and arguing about how they marinated and how they pick the pig and all of this stuff. But to me, I love the rice dishes. I think there's a delicacy to them that I really love. And I love making them. And I love that way everything cooks together. And they're very much about family and everybody, you know, just having this one pot, one dish meal that everybody enjoys. And that those, the rice dishes to me are, there's, those are the ones that I'm the most nostalgic for, that I love making, that if I have anybody coming to my home that I want to show, have them a real Cuban, what I think of as a true Cuban meal, it's usually one of those arroz con pollo or arroz con calamares or one of those dishes. I love making those.
Well, it certainly has whetted my appetite.
Good.
And you can find a lot of these wonderful recipes in Anna's book, The Cuban Table, A Celebration of Food, Flavors, and History. Anna, thank you so much for sharing all your information with me today.
Thank you for having me.
I feel that we could just keep talking about all these different cuisines and cultures.
I probably
so many.
Could. So,
so many of them,
you're
going
to have to cut me off.
All right. Anna Sophia Palaz, thank you. And thank you for listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.